So I think in England, man, it always shows least in their game.
You know, you can always really change a situation like that. Really, you know, something's gone wrong. You know, there's been a big noise, and everyone turns around to look. You know, you can always stand up and take a bow, which instantly makes everybody smile, which detracts from the. If you stand and go, you know, because they're all looking at you, it just makes the thing worse. But if you stand up and do something real stupid, you know, take a bow, quick tap dance or something, yeah. you know, is it?
True.
You know, it just diffuses it. Right, so let's have a look at some problems this week. Part 3. Page 7. In no particular order, but... distortion. Always caused by something somewhere overloading. Okay? That means that somewhere in the system, something is trying to do more work than it's capable of. And distortion is nearly always electronic. Some kind of a circuit somewhere trying to perform a function that it just isn't designed to do. Usually receiving too much voltage in some form or other, distortion, and it cracks up. If we think about a loudspeaker, is basically a magnet with a coil and a piece of cardboard. The more volume you push into a loudspeaker, the further forward and backwards the cone tries to move. That's its only function in life, is to move backwards and forwards. It's actually quite difficult to get a loudspeaker to move so far and so far that it distorts. Usually it'll rip, you know, it'll tear or something before you get to those kind of extremes. So if a speaker goes faulty in some way, it's a mechanical noise that you hear. What can happen sometimes is that they go off centre. But somewhere, I think at the back, we've got a diagram of a loudspeaker. Oh, you got it. Right, it's just after the wiring diagram. So what you can see is a coil. It's all right. You can see a coil within a magnet, within a gap, and the gap tolerance is quite tight. It's quite closely machined, and it's actually held in place by what's called a spider, which runs beyond the magnet, which is just a kind of a fabric which is attached to the cardboard. The cone is actually made of paper of some sort, usually, or some kind of thin plastic. And it's just attached by plastic, which is just glued on. And it's glued on in such a way that the coil moves in and out without scraping on the sides of the magnet. But sometimes if it's been thumped or banged or constantly hit with far too much volume, it can actually shift off center, and you get this kind of grinding noise, metallic grinding noise, which is one of the most common faults with speakers. And it simply means that the coil is grinding against the magnet, which usually means that it dies quite quick because of the friction that sets up in there. It gets really hot, and the coil just tends to demise really quick, and so the speaker stops working. You get what's called an open circuit, and it just stops working. The only other thing you can do with a speaker to make it sound really interesting is to put your finger through the cone, or the roadie's knee is the favourite one. When they pick a speaker box up, and it, you know, you rip the cone, and then you get this flap noise, you know. But apart from that, a speaker can't do much else. It either tends to work or tends to stop. So speakers tend not to be the point of distortion, is what I'm trying to say, the distortion point. So if we backtrack through the system from the speaker backwards, let's go look at the components and see where it is. One other thing about speakers, here we've got, is the RMS. RMS is really hard to understand. It means rough mean square. And if anyone can tell me what that means.
It's the root of the mean square.
The root of the mean square, yeah. Well, there you go. It's the root of the mean square. Is that fine? I just assume that it's some kind of average figure that is used to rate the power handling of the speaker. And it's used to match the speaker up to the amplifier that's going to push the speaker. Let's go a bit further back and we get to the amplifier stage. This is the power amp, the main PA amp. This would be the one that's in the office. Amplifiers can distort, of course they can, because they're electronic, they're electric circuits. But it's actually quite difficult to distort a PA amp. Because usually they tend to be quite big. Now if we had, say, a 20 watt PA amp in St. Paul's trying to drive those two speakers, then we'd distort it to high heaven. But as the thing is 600 watts a channel, the chances of us distorting it and still having someone left alive in the building are really quite quite small. So, an amp's power is measured in wattage. That's the way you rate an amplifier, is how many watts can it do. Interestingly enough, it's the same way you measure a light bulb. Watts. So I always equate wattage with heat. An amplifier is capable of generating heat because it's an AC voltage going through a coil. And so a 100 watt amp, if it's driven to full level, will generate the same amount of heat as a 100 watt light bulb. It gets quite hot. And of course there's no vacuum in a speaker. But we're talking about heat, so when you're talking about wattage, we're talking about heat. And to me, it gives you an average assessment of the amp's power. So the peak, like that's the absolute maximum of the amp, the peak of the amp will usually be twice as much as the RMS. So a 100 watt amp will peak at 200 watts. The reason, I suppose, for knowing that kind of thing is if you've got a 50 watt speaker on a 100 watt amp and it peaks at 200 watts, you're in for trouble. Because the heat generated by the amp will just burn the coil out. Too much heat through the wire and it just goes black and useless and that's it, done. When an amp distorts, it's called clipping. When any circuit really distorts, it's called clipping. Happens when the amp is no longer capable of delivering the waveform in its original form. Now, if you imagine a waveform, like remember last week we did the sine waves, you know, with the ups and the downs. Well, if the top of the sine wave is perfectly nice and round like this, then it's not clipped. But if you turn the amp up so far that it cannot deliver the waveform, then what you get is it goes up and clips the top off the waveform, comes down again, clips the bottom off the waveform. There's a diagram at the back somewhere. Here you go. Probably the very last thing in there, is it? That's an attempt to show you the difference between a clean waveform in part B and a clipped waveform in part A. It's not to any scale and the figures don't really mean a lot, but it gives you an idea of what a clipped waveform is. The one on the left is clipped, the one on the right isn't. And the reason being that we're trying to push more wattage through the amplifier than the amplifier can actually handle. So that's what it means when we say clipped. Yeah, it's bad news for your speakers. A clipped or distorted waveform is bad news for your speakers because a distorted waveform generates more heat than a clean one. I don't kind of know why. It just is. A clipped waveform generates more heat in the coil of the speaker than a clean waveform. And as it's heat that kills speakers, distortion kills speakers quicker. Most amps will have some kind of an LED or a meter device of some sort on that will tell you if it's clipping. They usually have a pair of red LEDs or something that will blink on and off if the amp's up in the danger area. I very much doubt whether you'll ever see that on the one in St. Paul's, but I think it does have clip LEDs. Okay, so assuming that the speaker's okay and the amp isn't clipping, let's come back down the chain a bit further to the mixer and see what we can get to distort there. Now the mixer is quite nice for generating distortion if you set it up the wrong way. The Mackie mixer that we've got in the church, that actual make of mixer, is really good. It's almost impossible to distort it, to be honest. I think if you tried really, really hard with a keyboard and a DR box, you'd manage it, but you never will with a microphone. You'll just never make it distort, I don't think. It's got a headroom of plus 22 dB, which is a long way up. That's up in the realms of really professional studio equipment. It's good gear. Very good equipment. Right, we need to consider two aspects of the mixer. The output side. You know, a mixer has lots of inputs, and it tends to have only a couple of outputs of different types. But we're talking about here the main output volume, the main output faders, right? On our desk, we only have one output fader for the master volume. The one on the very extreme right is the master volume for the whole system, right? What sometimes we don't realize is that that master volume fader has an input signal too. I know you guys will get this, but the sum of all the channels, like you've got 20 microphone channels on the desk, the sum output of all of those 20 channels comes to that one fader. So there's a real potential for distortion in there. If we have all the channel faders up really quite loud and the master fader down quite low, it's possible to get it to distort. I mean, there's an amplifier under there, a mix amplifier under there, and it's quite possible to get it to distort, except that it's a Mackie and it's really quite difficult to get Mackies to distort. But on some mixers, you could blow the living daylights out of that mix amp. Cheaper mixers, you know, you could really seriously do damage to them. It's always better to have the output faders up around the unity gain mark or the 0 dB mark. Then you get the channel faders accordingly. It's best to start with the output fader up where about it's going to be, and then take the channel faders up to get the desired volume. You only have to do it once or twice, and then you kind of know where things are going to be, and then you can just do it with your eyes shut. You know, it's not something you have to do meticulously every session. Okay, the second thing to consider is the actual channel itself, and we touched on this a little bit last week. The channel has an input side and an output side, okay? If you consider the channel fader, each channel fader to be an output volume which feeds sound out of the channel and into the mix bus, which goes to that master fader at the end. If you consider that to be an output, then the input to the channel is the channel gain at the top. The top of every channel is a channel gain. And that channel gain really is this whole secret to the mixer. Above anything else, that one control is really quite important. If you have the input gain too high, and by necessity you have to bring the channel fader down low, then the chances are you'll distort the channel. If you have the input gain too low, consequently you have to have the channel fader up quite a long way up, then you'll introduce noise to the system, except on a Mackie because they're so blooming quiet. The way to avoid distortion and the correct way to set up the channels on the desk is like this. You set the output master fader to about its unity gain point. Right, it's actually marked with a U on the Mackie, right? So it's easy to find. You set that about there. Then on the channel you want to work on, you push the PFL button. Do you know what a PFL button is? Okay, PFL stands for pre-fade listen. Or solo. Some channels have what's called a solo button. Solo. It's the same difference. Some call it PFL, some call it solo. What happens is you push the solo button, and what you get is that channel, that individual channel, the output from that is read on the meters on the right-hand side. It also goes into the headphone socket, so if you've got the earphones on, you push that button, then you only hear that channel, okay, solos it. So if you do that, you push the solo button on the channel while someone's doing something down a mic or a keyboard or something, or there has to be someone there doing something. And then what you do is you turn you put the channel fader up to the U mark, the unity gain mark, and then you simply turn the channel gain up so that the reading you get on the meters is approximately unity, preferably slightly under, with the peaks hitting about unity. So, you know, unity there, solo button, turn the gain up till you get about unity reading on the meters. A little bit over is fine, under is fine, but average, you know, approximately. If you do that, the channel set up, it won't distort, and you'll have the proper sort of signal-to-noise ratio throughout the whole system. It's that simple. And you can do it in a few minutes, even while the band's practicing or while the singers are singing. You can just nip down all the channels one by one, bing, 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 you know, just bing, tweak, bing, tweak, bing, tweak. It takes a few minutes. You can even do it while the meeting started, you know, if you need to. But if you use that as a sort of a technique for setting up the channel gates, then the channels will never distort. You'll never see the red lights coming on the channels unless someone sneezes, coughs, splutters, or does something really stupid with the microphone. The same's true, obviously, for keyboards and guitars and that, you know. I mean, you just set the channels up in exactly the same way. And then all you do, once you've got all your channels set up, is you just move the channel faders to a point where you find this is the right balance. It's best to turn things that are loud down than turn things that are quiet up to a point, but you just set your balance. We'll have to have a hands-on session, really, to go through quite a bit of this, because there's other things to consider, routing switches and things, which I haven't put in this, but we'll do we'll do with a hands-on, because you only have to see it once and then you'll know. Okay, so we've got the speaker sorted, the amp sorted, the mixer sorted. The last link in the chain really is what's on the platform, i.e. the microphones or the instruments. So a quick look at both of those, very quick. Microphones. It's almost impossible to distort a mic with a voice. I mean, most microphones will easily handle a SPL, which translates to sound pressure level, of 120 decibels. I think the loudest voice that's ever been recorded was about 118. I'm not sure on that, but it's something like that. But I mean, it would have to be horrendously loud, of a scream or a shout, to achieve 120 dB, and microphones will handle 120 dB, so you're not going to distort the microphones. However loud someone sings, however loud someone's voice is, they're really not going to distort the mic. They may well distort the mic preamp on the other end, but that's a different kettle of fish. If you shove a microphone inside, say, a bass drum, you know, I mean, that can generate levels of 120 dB. But even there, you'll find it quite difficult to distort things. And the other thing, the other consideration, the number two, would be the instruments. And we did cover this last week, really, but it's about guitars and keyboards and matching them up to the mixer. You know, you never plug a guitar, for instance, straight into the mic input of a mixer. You never, ever do that. I mean, even if you had a cable that would, you know, with a jack one end and an XLR the other end, you never plug a guitar straight into that, because the mismatch will sound horrible, for one thing. And if we've got phantom power switched on, then it's good night Vienna for the pickups and the guitar and stuff. So, does anyone know what phantom power is? Phantom power is a DC voltage which is supplied by the mixer down every mic line. From the mixer, it goes down every line onto the platform, so it's there at the socket. If you've got a multimeter and stick the probes in between the negative and the two positive lines, you'll find 50 volts DC, or 48 volts, it should be officially, but 50 volts is. And it's there simply to power up microphones that have little preamps built in, like the one on the lectern that we've just started to use, that funny looking thing, actually has got a little preamp built in somewhere, and it needs a voltage to run. So most studio mics need a voltage to run. They're called condenser mics, really, but you get a much better quality of sound with a condenser mic, and a much better signal, because it's got an amplifier built in. Right, it's a little amplifier built in there to send a signal down the cable, but it needs a voltage to work, so the mixer supplies the voltage, and it's called phantom power. On the mixer in the church, there's just a single switch on the back of the desk which turns it on or off. If it's on, it's on every mic channel. If it's off, it's off. Better quality mixers or more expensive ones would have an individual one for each channel, but we don't have that. So phantom power is this 50 volts flying down the cable. So if you plug your guitar straight in, you've got 50 volts hitting your circuitry on the guitar, which is not the best thing for them, right? It can be even worse for a keyboard. If you plug a keyboard straight in, you can really mess the output stage of the keyboard, whatever's there, a preamp of some sort. They really do not like having that kind of voltage fired at them. So we always use a DI box for instruments. Always, always use a DI box. In the DI box is a transformer, and the transformer isolates the instrument from the voltage, right? Because it's a DC voltage, it doesn't translate across. I mean, you understand that, and you understand that, right? You have to have an AC voltage going through a coil for it to induct across to the other side, but DC voltage doesn't do that. So just remember, if you haven't got a clue what I'm talking about, that if it's a guitar, a bass guitar, or a keyboard, it goes into a DI box, and the DI box goes into the wall. That's usually the only way the plugs will match up, to be honest, because a quarter-inch guitar jack just won't go into the plates on the platform. But just so that you know. Okay, let's move on to the next point here. Feedback. Wonderful, glorious feedback. Causes. All right, feedback is what's called a howl round. It's a loop, if you like, and it's caused by sound looping through the system at ever-increasing volume until it reaches a point where it has a pitch, and there's your squeal or your hum or your... What happens usually is that the microphone picks up the sound that's coming out of the speaker, which of course sends it back around to the amplifier and sends it out of the speaker again, and it picks it up again and sends it back around again and picks it up again, and so you have this loop. That's what feedback actually is. It's just the microphones picking up the sound coming from the speakers and amplifying it all over again. It builds up very quickly, doesn't it, Dunk? You know that, don't you? It's almost instantaneous. especially with radio clip mics. They're just the killers, they are. Just so you know, I mean, I don't know if I did this last time, but just so that you know that, like, this is a clip mic that I'm wearing here. For some reason that I have no idea why, people who make clip mics like this, like Shure and whatever, this is a Soundcraft one, they make them with a pickup pattern that's called Omni. Now, Omni simply means that it picks up in every direction at once. I don't know why they do that, but these mics are always Omni. The other kind of mic that you'll get, like your vocalist kind of mic, is called a cardioid. Now, a cardioid mic only picks up from the front. And, if you get round the back or round the side of it, the response and volume just tails off. So that directly from the back of the microphone, the pickup's very minimal. But this thing, for instance, if you were listening to a tape recorded at St. Paul's Church and someone on the back row sneezed, you would hear it loud and clear, because this will pick it up. That's why they're so hard to get any volume through the PA, because the speakers are just up there, and this thing is capable of picking up those speakers quite nicely, you know. I don't know why they don't make a cardioid version of a clip mic, but there you go. So that's one of the reasons why it's difficult to get a clip mic to work with any kind of volume. Right, cures for feedback. The obvious cure is to turn something down. But you will probably be aware that it's happened lots of time at St. Paul. So there's been a bit of a squeak and someone's turned something down, and then suddenly you can't hear what anyone's saying anymore. There's a bit of the baby in the bathwater problem here, you know. I mean, if it squeaks a bit, you know, it's not so much turn it down as you know, weld it off. Which is... Only it makes the problem worse. You know, you then have a second problem. Instead of a squeak, you've got silence, you know, and you don't want either. So let me just try and point you in a few directions here. Angling the speakers is not really viable at St. Paul's, because you need a 20-foot ladder to get up there in the first place. Keeping the mic behind the speakers is somewhat out of your control, because you know what these preachers are like. they might stay behind the speakers, but they might want to jump off and go walkies. You know, Colin Urquhart was a tinker for that. In Roffey Place, which was only a small room, it was only seat 200 people, right? And we had these Bose speakers hanging down on chains, you know, one each side. I mean, they were only, well, you could probably almost reach up and touch them, you know, that kind of height. And he would walk off the platform and stand directly underneath one of them. It seemed to be his favourite place to stand, you know. He would walk around a bit, but he would always spend a lot of time directly underneath this speaker. And when you're directly underneath a speaker, you get an increase in bass response. I don't know why it is. You just get an increase in bass. if you go anywhere where there's a fly-in PA system, you know, that you can actually get directly underneath, you'll find that the bass gets really loud. You know, so what do you get? Colin standing there. So what I used to do, and this is something that maybe you can consider, is I used to pan the microphone away from that speaker to the other speaker. If you would stand there, I would use the pan control to move the sound slightly that way. Not all the way that way, but slightly that way. So that speaker's turned down and that one's turned up. And that way you get some kind of compensation for the fact that one speaker's gone down because the other one's gone up. So I mean, it's something you can think about. If you do get a person who likes to walk right in front of the speakers, and if you're watching what you do, you can pan the sound off the other way, which will help. It'll help with the feedback problem, and hopefully there'll be enough volume coming from the other side to compensate. You know, I mean, it's just something you do as a quick fix. All right. Set it back to normal as soon as it's physically possible. Angle of speakers, okay, we can't do that. Keep behind the speakers, can't really do that. Turn the mic down. Well, I hate turning microphones down. I really hate turning microphones down. To me, that defeats the object. So, on point two there, turning the mic down. Remember that what we've got here is a loop. We've got feedback is a loop, right? But a loop can be broken. You can break it by turning the mic off, okay, but that doesn't, you know, that's not an acceptable thing for me. But what you can do to break the cycle, break the loop, is just knock it down and back up again. Quite quick. It breaks the cycle. Now, it might be that, you know, if the guy stood close to the speaker or something, you know, you come straight back into another loop. But you can really knock it down and back up quite quick, even if it doesn't go quite up as far as it was. It can literally be, and that's enough to break that cycle of the howl or the whistle without people noticing too much that the thing actually ever went off. Maybe something you have to experiment with, and depending on the situation and the speaker and the voice that he's got and how loud he's speaking and all of those variables, you know, to some point it works. Just break the cycle. Boom, that quick. And once you've broken the loop, the whistle stops straight away. And, you know, hopefully the guy can carry on speaking and you haven't lost too much of what he said. The EQ controls. Remember we talked last week about EQ, finding those really loud offending frequencies that are related to the size, shape of the building and turning them down. I'll show you that when we have a hands-on session. Most of the channels are set up for it anyway, but I'll show you that. And the last thing there is you can actually buy a box, which is an anti-feedback device, which will automatically seek out those nasty frequencies for you and turn them down. The trouble is they're expensive, and they tend to knock big holes in the sound, and not so good for music situations. Okay for speech, not so good for music. It's like, you guys, and it's like a variable filter that can seek wherever the feedback is, whatever frequency is actually ringing, they can seek that, find it, and turn it down. And some of them will have like 10 of these filters in a single box. So you can do multiple frequencies, you know, but they do tend to knock big holes in the audio. And they're expensive. And we haven't got one. Okay, let's fly on here. Tips. And this is a part and parcel of what problem you had, Duncan. Be aware that two mics in close proximity will interfere with one another. I don't know the technical reason why, but like if Carol and I are out on a mission, for instance, you know, and we've got our own PA set up, we've got our monitors set up the way they would be, I've got my clip mic on, like, and we've been playing, and I stand up to speak, I always have to turn off both the mics, you know, my microphone here, click, and Carol's microphone on the stand, I have to turn it off, because if I don't turn that off and I turn this on, away it goes. Even though this one's at the same volume, it's fine. I don't know why it is, but it is definitely the case. Now, we can look at it, the lectern mic, on the platform. Now we've got this nice new Lexan mic, which is good and serves a good purpose, does a good job. But of course, if people are unaware of what microphones are doing, you'll see often see people stood there with the handheld, and the lectern's on as well, and they've got the handheld as well. And you get interference. The clip mic, of course, gets double the amount of interference than the handheld. I don't know why, but it's probably the pickup pattern. If the two mics are on, for instance, and someone's got a Bible like this, right, and they move it, you get what's called phasing, because of the sounds bouncing off the Bible, getting to one mic and getting to another mic, and as the gap changes, you get this sound. You ever heard that? And we'll try and get Pastor to do it next time he's on. It's quite fun. But the worst thing, of course, is that they just feed back. I mean, any clip mic near another mic will feed back like stink. Of course, the answer is to turn down the one that's not being used. Now, that's a variable, isn't it? Whichever one is being used, you decide, because you're the one on the desk. So you decide which one's giving you the best audio and turn the other one off.
Yeah, I finally got to turn it off, because I had it right down from you all the way down, but it wasn't right off.
Mm.
And it was in a bit above the end stop.
Mm. Well, usually 20 dB is enough for something to call something as off. If it's down 20 dB below its normal working place, then you can effectively say it's safe. But, subject to these things breaking all the rules of everything. The Lexan mic, of course, works really good as long as the people stay fairly still. I mean, they can go backwards and forwards in a straight line, and that mic's designed to cope with that. As they go back, it'll get thin, but it'll still be there. The sound will thin out. As they go forward, it'll thicken up because of proximity effect. But if they go like this, it's amazing how quick that mic dies from the side. I mean, a foot, get 1 foot away from center, and it really does start to go away. So if the clip mic's gummed on the person and you're using the lectern mic, you'd have to crossfade between the two. Great fun, isn't it? You're just sitting there like this. But sometimes you have to do it. It goes with the territory, as I'd say to a Polonaise. It's part of the package. Monitors can feedback, of course they can, if they're too loud. And that is one other prominent source of feedback, is the vocal monitors. And remember what we said the other week about vocalists having this problem about hearing their own voice. Was that the first week or the second week? I can't remember.
It was last week,
so you didn't get that.
Funny, we talked about that, and last week I really could not hear myself. Mm. That's the worst there's ever been, I've felt like.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, I could hear on video, but it was because you said that.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's just a strange, for Duncan, it's just this strange phenomenon that a person with a microphone standing in front of a speaker with other people either side of them with microphones and all sound coming from one speaker, they tend not to be able to hear themselves. I don't really know why it is, but I assume it's something to do with the fact that the voice is in their own head here, audibly, and it masks out the sound from the speaker. Of course, they can hear the next door neighbour coming out like a rocket, you see. But the same is true if you move to the next door, then this person can't really hear themselves, but they can hear this one, so you kind of can sometimes get this camaraderie, if you like, or banter between singers. Oh, she's too loud, I can't hear myself, It's one of those weird and wonderful situations. Only if you put your ear all by the monitors, you find all the singers are coming out at a rate of knots, And yet all of them will say, well, I can't hear myself. And what they usually want is the monitors turned up. Obviously, there's a finite limit to how far you can turn a monitor up before it starts to howl and squeal or boom or do nasty things. Always keep the mics pointing away from the monitors. Our singers have just about got this one sorted, to be honest. But there could be a case of perhaps someone new coming in. Or sometimes you forget, and there's the monitor there, and the singer's like this, and sometimes they'll let it drop like this. Hildy did it once when she was singing. And of course, if you mic up a speaker, you're going to get a serious howl, and this is what you get. I always tell our singers to, when they put the mics on the floor, that they're pointing away from the monitor. Of course. Uh-huh. Monitor EQ is good, but we haven't got it. You can use the same trickery with equalization on the monitors as you do for the main PA, but you need a separate equalizer. Imagine that the output from the mixer is coming out at line level and it's going into an amplifier at line level. If you could patch in an equalizer between the two, then you could alter the character of the monitors to such a way that they would feedback less. But we haven't got one. You will have noticed, probably, or you will notice anyway as you start to operate the system, that you can sometimes get what I call the coach station effect. It's like this distant rumble. You'll sometimes hear it when pastor starts up in the morning, and you know, and he's saying, like, let's take our seats, and he sounds like he's 4 miles away. You know, you can hear something, but it's distant and it's boomy and it's indistinct. That's usually because what you can hear is what's coming out the monitors on the platform. And if for a band's rehearsing or something like that, and you actually turn the main PA off, and what you hear coming out the monitors is this rumbly sound. And it's miles away, and it's a rumble. And it's down to the fact that the platform itself is like a wooden cavity. It's a wooden box. So the platform itself is like a bass box. You know, you jump up and down on it, it goes boom. You know, it adds bass. It would be really nice if we could EQ or have an equalizer on the monitors and knock all the bottom end right out, all the bass below the voice. You know, it's like 100 cycles or something. Just take it out. Wouldn't half stop that boom. But as I say, we can't do it. So if ever you're aware of this sort of boomy noise, especially, say, if someone's preaching, maybe, say, they're using a handheld mic and they're preaching, and you've got this kind of distant, boomy, rumbly thing, it's because it's still cranked up in the monitors and it's coming out on the platform at a rate of knots and then feeding back into the auditorium. Of course, it's coming in a bit late because the monitors are facing the wrong way and pointing up. So what you're hearing is like a reflection off the wall and coming out. So you get that, this, it's just like a rumbly noise. And the cure for that, obviously, is to knock the preach mic out of the monitors, turn the fallback sends down. And then you'll usually find, when you do that, that all the bass goes away at the mic and you instantly want to turn more bass on. It's quite strange. Especially if it's like the same mic's being used for the worship leader as for the priest, like the handheld radio mic. If say, Steve's used it, then the band need that to be quite loud through the monitor so that we know where we're supposed to go. You know, we need to hear him say, you know, verse 2 or whatever he says, you know, so we get it. And then you pass it over to the preacher, and it's coming, it's like, phew, you know, on the platform, it really rockets through, you know. So you need to be aware of the fact sometimes you have to knock the monitor. The preach mic has to go out of the monitors. The lectern mic never goes into the monitors. You never put the lectern mic in the monitors. It'll howl like stink because it's a mic that picks up from a, you know, a distance. The tie clip mic never goes in the monitors because that's only ever used for a preaching, and the monitors are no use to a preacher because they're all behind him anyway. Right. Hums, buzzes, radio and earth loops. Hum. Hum comes from two sources. Mains hum. Well, sometimes, I'm trying to think how this would, an actual situation. Say, on the platform now, we've got currently two DI boxes running. We've got one for the main piano, which is a bigger box, and we've got one for Carol's guitar, right, which is ordinary. But they're plastic boxes, not metal. So they're not shielded, they're plastic. Now, if you happen to get one of those plastic boxes and shunt it round so that it goes near the mains, the four-way mains block, that's got a DC supply plugged into it, you get a really nice fizz, a really very, very nice zzz sound through the whole system, because the transformer gets into the DI box. It's inductance. It gets inducted in. So if ever you hear a vzzz sound, one of the first places you're going to look is for the DI boxes. Make sure they're clear of all the mains points. It wouldn't match if we had metal DI boxes, because they'd be screened. But they're plastic. So fizz buzzes. There's quite a nasty buzz on the monitor amp most of the time. I can't figure out what it is. I don't know what it is, to be honest. But if you get a real loud one, chances are, over the space of time, someone has kicked the DI boxes somewhere near one of those DC supplies, and it's tracking across. All right. Earth loops. Most common source of hum is an earth loop. I actually did do a diagram of an earth loop somewhere. Yeah, that's it. Whatever page that is. Have you got it? Now, two of you guys will know what an earth loop is straight away, but there you go, that bottom diagram. It's simply a way of the signal being earthed twice. Like, you can see a picture of a mixer and a guitar amp, and you can see that there's a mains earth on the mixer, which of course there should be, but there's also a mains earth on the guitar amp, which of course there should be. The trouble is, now you've got a connection between the mixer and the guitar amp in the audio domain via a box. So you've effectively got a loop, and that sometimes will cause a hum. If the DI box is a good one, it'll have a switch on it called an earth lift switch. If it has, that's your instant cure. It just breaks the earth connection between the mixer and the amp. And problem solved. If it hasn't, it might have an input on it with no earth. Some DI boxes will have two different types of input, one normal, one that's got no earth on it, so that you can click in either one. All DI boxes have a link socket, and that diagram there would be a typical example of the DI boxes plugged into the mixer, right, via the wall and the box on the wall and the platform. And then the guitarist is plugged into the DI box. The DI box has taken a link out and gone into his amp so that he can still use his amp. That's a typical situation of a link, a hookup. Without an earth lift system, that will almost certainly cause an earth loop, which will manifest itself as a 50-cycle hum. That's a low-pitched hum. If you don't have an earth lift switch, you have to break the earth somehow, but the answer is not to take the earth lead off the amp or the mixer. Because I think I said here, it's better to hear the hum than the sound of the ambulance.
Have all the ones which have got these switches?
No. No. But we tend not to have earth loop problems, so it's not a problem. No. I only give you that information, just... it might be useful to you one day. You always break the signal earth, not the mains earth. Because the mains earth is there to save your life. Radio pickup. Now, sometimes you can get obvious radio pickup. And again, the DI boxes and St. Paul's are pretty professional when it comes to picking up radio 2 or radio 4. I mean, it depends to a point on atmospherics outside the church. I don't know why radio travels better in some days than others, but some days you just get it coming through the system and it's really a stinker to get rid of, and other days it's quiet. But radio pickup, again, is usually down to earth of some sort or bad screening of some sort. Can be, if you're using microphone cables that have got plastic XLR plugs on them, not metal ones, and we do have some of those at St. Paul's. Because obviously plastic is non-conductive, so it's breaking the screen connection. And where the screen connection is broken, radio can get in. Radio can manifest itself in several different ways. Obviously, if you get a station coming through and music, like you hear in the monitors sometimes when you're on the platform, you can hear music coming through the monitors that, you know, is definitely not from the band. It's all, you can only hear it when it's quiet, you know, perhaps when pastor's praying like this, you know, it's radio. I mean, that's obvious because it's demodulated, it's a radio station. But it can come in different forms, like cracks, buzz sounds, pop sounds, fizzy sounds. Guitars can be quite good at picking up at radio. We had one this weekend where we were in Cambridge. The bass guitar was really good at picking it up. If the guy actually took his hands off the strings, it was in, you know, this fizzy sound. And it's radio. As soon as you touch it, you know, even though it's quite probably high impedance, isn't it? Your skin contact or whatever it was, it shorted it out and it went away. It used to happen in the studio quite a bit. And I used to get funny looks from guitarists when I'd come out with this piece of wire and I'd wrap the piece of wire around their finger, you know, and then bang it around the, or this one, and then bang it around the back of the bridge somewhere on the guitar so that even if they took their hands off, they were still connected. They used to look at me ever so funny, but it used to work. It's down to bad screen or bad earthing on the guitar in some form or other, but the strings can act like an aerial, and then the pickup picks it up off the strings and transmits it. And so it, you know, fizzes, buzzes and things like that from instruments tend to be some kind of radio pickup. You're always going to be looking for the screen connection to be good. Plastic plugs are bad. Even plastic guitar jacks can be bad because the plastic battle of the thing is there's no screen. They should make them out of conductive plastic, I suppose. And of course our DI boxes, as I said, are plastic, so they're not shielded at all, so they're quite prone to picking up stray stuff. I mean, if you get the odd taxi going past who happens on a good day to blast through, then, you know, I mean, that used to happen at Zion Chapel up in Park Street when we were there. You get this taxi go past and it come through the PA system at a rate of knots, and you know, if the language was good, it was a, you know, it was a good day. If the language wasn't good, then it was hallelujah quick, you know. Try and cover it up. They're just things that might happen. The loop system, just worthy of note here, you know, the loop system, and we talked about this, but the loop system is a special kind of amplifier that drives a coil, which in St. Paul's runs around the floor, and it's under the rubber channel stuff which is on the carpet, and it's a coil of wire runs around there, and the amp pushes audio through there, and people can switch their hearing aids to a position whereby they can hear what's being transmitted in the loop. The problem is the guitars can pick that same signal up from like 4 miles away, and it manifests itself as a really high pitched squeal. A really high pitched, you know, really nasty one, you know, the dog range one, you know. And sometimes, used to be the case down in the church down south where we were, where they ran the coil across the back of the platform. Imagine, to get to the area of seats where there, because the loop amp was in a amplifier cupboard at the back, and they ran the cable across the back. I mean, the guitar amps were just smothered in this really thin, nasty, horrible noise coming through. And there was no way we could get rid of it. In St. Paul's, it's not so bad because the platform's one end and the loop amp's down the other end, so we've got at least a bit of space. But you'll find if you turn the loop amp up too much, and I mean from the mixer, whatever it is, AUX 4 or AUX 5, whatever, whichever one feeds it, if you turn it up too much, you'll find you generate on the platform this kind of nasty sound, scratchy sound. It really gets into the monitors. Really is, you know. So I've actually got the loop turned down quite a long way right now, and so far no one has said anything. But I mean, it's always possible that one day someone will wander in and say the loop's not working. I mean, there was a time when it stopped working for some reason or other, it just packed in. And people did start to come up and say, look, the loop's not working. And since it's been fixed and that, I mean, I'm running it really a lot quieter, and so far no one has said anything, so, you know, if it ain't buzzed, don't fix it. Leave the volume down. because it saves the people on the platform from earache. And sometimes guitars can pick it up, in which case it comes out of the guitar and it's a very thin, trebly sounding, scratchy noise. It's really horrid. It also, since I've turned it down, it's stopped the PA feeding back quite a bit. We can actually run the PA a wee bit better now and a wee bit louder without so many howls and squeals and things since I turned the loop amp down. So just keep it down there, guys. Eh? Okay, just the last thing here. There's some tips at the bottom. And this things that I've found along the way. Never coil a mains cable when it's in use. Now, that's not so bad with a guitar amp or anything like that, but I mean, one time there was a wedding on at the big church down south we were, and they were running a Tiern, like a big thing, you know what I mean? And they had a big cable, it was a thick cable, but they had this almighty loop drum of this thing that was plugged into one. I tell you, it was so hot, that loop. If you coil mains cable, it generates heat. That's okay, you know, guitar amps probably never have any trouble, but it's good practice never to coil mains cables because they will get warmer. Wherever the coil is, they'll generate heat, you know. And if they're rubber, they can melt the insulation and then you've got a big fire. You know. In fact, we very nearly had a fire down there through that. I pulled it out. I mean, it was so close to... The rubber was tacky and sticky and it was so close. There you go. Because people don't know about things like that, you know. So, I mean, you guys... being an electronics will, but a bog standard Harry like me, you know, you have to find these things out the hard way. Always have a non-earth signal cable just in case. Well, sometimes that works and sometimes that doesn't. If you have an earth loop situation like we described earlier and the DI box doesn't have a switch to break the earth, sometimes you can achieve the same effect by having a guitar lead with the earth not connected. So you use that to connect from the DR box to the guitar amp. That breaks the earth loop, but it's technically still earth via one path somewhere, so it still works. Sometimes you can use a resistor in a couple of ohms or something in it, but I've never found that to be very effective. Try to keep mains cables away from mic cables. Sometimes... again, depending on the quality of the cable, sometimes you can get a hum induced into the mic cables if it runs past mains cables. Especially if the mains cables are in a big wadge, you know, like they're never neat and tidy, are they? So there's a big wadge and you run a mic cable over the top. It's quite possible to induce a hum in there. So you just keep them separate on the floor. That would also be true for monitor speaker cables. You know, because they run across the floor as well. Like, imagine where Carol's is, right by the piano with all of those cables, you know, that monitor cable, speaker cables running around. We have had one occasion when we had a noise and I just moved the speaker cable out of the way of the mic cable and it went away. You know, so it's just to be aware of. Well, I think that's it for that. So, just some points for you. Any questions? Yeah, hands-on is always the best.
Yeah.
You know, and that would always be the plan, but it's best to give you some kind of background before the hands-on, and then you've got half a clue. When I say press the solo button, you've got half a clue what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, so this is just a bit of background info before you get into the real stuff. And it's like reading the highway code before you get behind the wheel, you know what I mean? It's something you really should do.